Hello and welcome to In Her Corner, a podcast dedicated to celebrating and empowering women working at every level of sport on and off the field. I'm your host, Lisely Sitali, and today I've got a really great guest, a woman whose career is incredibly impressive as it is interesting. It's the lovely Sonia Randev. Hello, Sonia. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you? Thank you for having me.
No, it's an absolute pleasure. It's an absolute pleasure. As I say there, Sonia has a really great career. She now works officially as a sports agent, but also has an incredibly impressive award-winning sports journalism career and has a record of being the many of first in here in the UK where we're based. So what I wanted to do, Sonia, was just sort of take a dive through to see how you got to this level that you're at and also to then look at some lessons along the way to hopefully help a few more women break the records that you have established here in British media and culture. So I just wanted to start off by saying, obviously, you're now a sports agent, a field that is incredibly male dominated in sports. If there was sort of like levels of pyramid of where women don't get much representation and a foothold, it's definitely in the sports agency side. So I just wanted to take a deep dive with you to say, how did you get to this point of establishing, obviously, your own successful agency and representing the athletes that you do, particularly in a sport like boxing?
Do you know what? It's quite interesting because I, you know, started my career off as a sports journalist.
Yeah.
So for me, it was very much, you know, that was my passion. I loved writing when I was at school. I wasn't really interested in writing about news or politics. Sports was just such a big part of my life growing up.
Yeah.
So I kind of went down that career path. And then I kind of fell into like the sports consultancy thing because, you know, I'd worked in a few commercial positions at TalkSport and at Trinity yeah. Mirror. And I started getting a buzz for like the sales yeah. and commercial side of things. So obviously the decision came after TalkSport was to try and kind of freelance and give it a go and see yeah. what I could achieve out of it. So like literally one of my very first clients was ex-Premier League footballer who actually went into boxing and became a professional yeah. boxer, McKenzie. So that was quite like a relatively biggish type of client to have. Like, you know, I'm yeah. kind of going into the unknown, you know, I'm testing my yeah. career. Can I do it? You know, will I live up to the expectations of what people probably kind yeah. of, you know, expected of me? So working with Leon was a fantastic experience and opportunity. You know, we generated quite a fair amount of revenue yeah. for him across his fights. PR was great because it gave me experience dealing with like media and stuff on the other side, as opposed to somebody coming to me and saying, hey, Sonia, yeah. could you interview this person? I was now going to them and saying, yeah. could you interview Leon? So that's kind of how it all kick-started. And then I kind of just started building up a name for myself in boxing. I think probably what was the most, I'm not going to say surprising because that's probably the wrong kind of word to use, but kind of a little bit disappointed that there just wasn't enough women, but also not enough women from, you know, from an Asian, yes. from a black kind of background that were kind of doing yeah. what I was doing in boxing. And I was like, where are these women? It needs to change. If I can do it, then you can do it.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I think it's definitely that barrier of exclusivity, right? Because I think particularly in the UK, when you look at how boxing has emerged and really kind of grown as a sport, if you look at everything from the federations, all the way to the training institutes, all the way to the promoters, of course, who are a huge part of the ecosystem of talent and representation, it is overtly white middle-aged males. And there are some women actually in the background, but again, it's white women, as you say, and it's mostly, again, women who come in through family or connections or through long-standing, say, business-to-business relationships mm. between people. So for you to make that break in there, as you say, it was almost kind of like a swerve from your glittering career in journalism that helped you to see that there was this commercial aspect to be done directly managing athletes. And did you find it at first quite lonely, or did you kind of take it in your stride as one of those sort of unique selling points of yourself to differentiate you from the rest of the field in that regard?
I think anything, when you're trying something new, you're kind of going into the unknown, it can always be quite daunting. You know, and yeah, you do feel alone. I think anybody that's freelance or, you know, you're kind of working for yourself, you do feel that kind of sense of loneliness, because I went from being in an office, like a vibrant and a buzzy office, to sitting in my room and yeah. booking, you know, a freelance consultancy by myself. So kind of miss that you know, that interaction with people and having a cup of tea and speaking to people in the kitchen. For me, I've always been quite a strong-minded woman, even throughout my 20s. There's a lot of things I had to battle in my personal life to get to where I needed to get to. So yes, I did struggle. And I think everybody would admittedly say, yes, they have struggled when you're trying to kind of embark on a new career path or a new journey, especially being a woman as well. It's not easy for us. They don't make it easy for us, and they never have.
No.
But, you know, it's all about being resilient and, you know, determined and having that, you know, that inner strength within you. So, well, hold on a minute. Just because I'm a woman doesn't necessarily mean I cannot be successful just like that person can, who is a male and working in a male-dominated industry. So I just worked really hard. I worked late hours for very little or no money. I think that needs to be made clear that when you do start off, you have to accept the fact that you can't go in demanding this X amount of money. I just built myself up and built my contacts up and, you know, started working with different boxes, mainly men. But the life-changing moment for me was working with the women in last year, because that's what I've always wanted to do. And I actually got the opportunity to do that, which was great.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. And I think what you say there about having that sort of mental resilience and acceptance that it's not going to be easy at the beginning is such an important learning in any walk in life. But I think, as you say, particularly when you're, you know, going through a path that very few have gone before. And I just want to sort of track back there, because you said, you know, obviously you were very strong-willed and you knew your mind and you had that conviction and self that came from your 20s, where you had problems and you had to overcome them personally, and that teaches you a set of skills, right, that you can take forward professionally. But where, if you were to go before those 20s, do you think that there was something within your upbringing or your love of sport that helped to create that level of zeal in you as a person?
Most definitely. I mean, you know, you speak to anybody that went to school with me, that grew up with me as a kid, I have always been sports crazy. I was very fast at running. I was a pretty decent footballer as well.
Yeah.
Right defence for my junior team, for my senior team. You know, I was offered trials for the England netball team, the under-15s, but I didn't want to take it because that was never my sole purpose in life, was to become an athlete. I always wanted to work in the sports industry, but not to become an athlete. So that wasn't a dream of mine. So I've always had that competitiveness and that strong will and that sacrifice to kind of, you know, elevate myself to the next level. So I think that anybody that is going to kind of work in this industry, having a passion for, you know, for sports as a whole, knowing your sports, and it's no disrespect to some people, this is across the board. I'm not the finished article. I wouldn't sit here and say I know everything about boxing or I know everything about football. But I have sometimes come across some people that I do often wonder, how did you get a job in this industry? Because I see no passion. I just see that you've obviously made the right connections, which is fine. It is all about making right connections. But in me to want to work with you or collaborate with someone, I need to feel that passion. I need to feel that you genuinely care about the sport that you're looking to pursue a career in.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think probably that is another factor that helps to elevate your relationship, right, when you're dealing with athletes. Because now, as you say there, you've worked predominantly with male athletes in boxing, and you now transition to work with female boxers. And we both share a mutual love and excitement for where we see the potential of women's boxing going, particularly here in the UK, where we have such a strong, talented set of female fighters. But do you think also that that's another thing that helps you to make a connection with your athletes that you represent, the fact that they can feel and see that you love sport and that you really get what it does for them as a human being beyond just, you know, the performance aspect?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm always there for the people that I've worked with. You know, I'm that type of person that if you need me, just WhatsApp me or call me. And I'm always there for them, even if they've got personal problems going on. You know, quite a few of them have called me up and said that they're stressed and they're worried about things. And, you know, I've sacrificed my own personal issues and my own personal life to ensure that they're okay. And I think that's really important for any agent or any representative, to make sure that the people that you are working with are okay. You know, checking in their mental health, checking is everything okay at home, is everything okay with your friends, are you having any personal issues with your partner if they do have a partner. So when you're working with someone, you take on every single aspect of their life, and people need to be prepared for that, you know. It's not easy. Like, you feel that too, because, you know, you are a human being at the end of the day. You've probably gone through similar things as what these athletes. These athletes are human beings. And I need to be real, to be myself with them, not to try and be something I'm not. I've seen a lot of people out there that have tried to be something that they're not. And athletes aren't stupid. They see through that. You know, they see through the people that have got their back and that haven't got their back.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think that that point there that you talk about, that empathy and that ability to really open yourself up and open your life to share a lot of that with them beyond just a professional sort of transactional relationship is really important, because I think a lot of people look at sports agents, and I think probably the most famous sports agents that haven't done a great job of representing, you know, what it should be about is in the football industry, which of course you have a lot of great experience in, is that people do misconceive and see the fact that football agents are very sort of the headlines that they make are very much about the money that they cut and the deals that they make, and so it ends up looking quite cutthroat and quite inhumane as an industry, and athletes there are very much treated as sort of like a commercial number, right? And how much they can get. How do you strike that fine balance between obviously wanting to build a really good personal deep relationship with the athlete, to have that trust and as you say, to be that support system for them in difficult moments, versus obviously needing to keep a professional sort of relationship too, so that, you know, how do you straddle that difficult line?
I think to begin with, I found that quite difficult because, you know, you've got to like the people that you're working with.
Yeah.
So for me, very much like there were times where I felt like I was spending and focusing more time on helping certain people through their personal issues.
Yeah.
And that was taking away the attention that my job was there to do, is ultimately to make money for you and to raise your profile and get people talking about
you.
So these are all learning curves. It's something that you will learn to detach, and sometimes you have to switch your feelings off.
Yeah.
You can be there for the person that you work with. But then when business comes to business, you'll be like, okay, I need to get on with this. This is what predominantly my job role is to generate as much revenue as I possibly can. I need to build your profile. And all the issues that you may be experiencing on the side is something that you just need to learn to balance. Everything in life is about balancing.
Yeah.
So that's the biggest advice I give to someone, that's not going to happen straight away. It's something that you learn.
Yeah.
And you need to give yourself time to learn that. And it's okay to sometimes get emotionally attached to someone or to somebody that you're working with. It just shows that you're human, but you do need to actually take a step back and be like, okay, you know, there are these problems. We're going to try and find solutions to these problems, but ultimately this is what I'm here to do. So you must make sure that you do not get the two kind of like too switched up in one another, because then it becomes, what is the point in you doing your job? You're there to make money for that person, and that's becoming a distraction. And that person's got too many personal issues and problems going on, it might be time for that person to take a break away.
Yeah.
You can still be there for them,
yeah,
but maybe take a break from everything that you're doing and then pick it up once that person's obviously got themselves back into a better position.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think it's about that boundary setting, right? I think it's what you say there about emotions. It's more a case of trying to understand where are you best placed to support the individual that you're looking after, because as you say, the first and foremost is definitely the welfare and their mental and their mental well-being. And we'll talk later on about how you've had personal struggles with this yourself, and you've had to have support systems around you that have recognized when to give you a break away from your professional life to get yourself into a headspace where you could then come back and manage all the pressures, because obviously these are pressures of performing in all jobs, but especially when you're in a sort of front-facing role like an athlete is and also a sports agent. And so I just wanted to also take some time with you now to talk a little bit more about your love for sport, and in particular what's driving your current focus, I should say, on female boxing. Where did that come from? Obviously, you were involved there, as you said, in boxing, first of all, transitioning a footballer to a boxing career. But where did you sort of start to look at women's boxing?
I've been passionate about women's boxing, like literally since the Olympics, following a lot of the girls' journeys on, when they were part of Team GB, not being very loud and vocal about it, I was very quiet about it.
Yeah.
I'd always be kind of keeping myself up to date with what was going on. And the biggest issue or obstacle that we faced is that there just isn't enough pool of women in boxing. So there wasn't enough fights being made. So therefore, it wasn't easy for me to kind of work with any of these girls. But then I ended up interviewing them for Boxing Monthly magazine. And I ended up saying, listen, girls, if you need my help this year in trying to raise your profile and get people to know who you are, to reach a bit more of a larger audience, just give me a shout and we can work on something. And the next thing you know, I'm working with practically all of them.
Yeah.
I've done something with every single one of those girls. And some of them are world champions now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I wanted to talk to you about that. How has been watching the journey of someone like Savannah Marshall, who, you know, had really, you know, for a lot of people who aren't diehard boxing fans, was not a household name, but now watching her really get up to her ascendancy and having conversations about, you know, having world title fights with the likes of Katie Taylor, of course, has become a huge household name, and Clarissa Shields across in the US. How does that make you feel as an agent? Is that kind of the moment you always live for and you wait that you'll see for your athlete, but sadly doesn't always happen? How do you transition that sort of phase?
You know what, like Savannah Marshall, she's an absolute character, but people never really kind of saw that side to her. Mm-hmm. You know, she's always kind of been linked with Clarissa purely in the fact that she's the only fighter to have beaten Clarissa in the amateurs. You know, and she's always going to have that over. It's been loads of back and forths between them two. It's been quite funny. It's been great. It's built up a lot of hype between the two girls. But with Savannah, she was someone that never really wanted to talk to the media. She just didn't want to do interviews. And I think people found that quite frustrating. Like journalists who just like, well, if she doesn't want to talk, we're not going to bother wasting our time.
Yeah. Well, where does that come from, if you don't mind me asking? Where does her reluctance to come from in not wanting to engage? Is it a case of not knowing and not having the confidence, or is it a case of seeing the media duties as a bit of a distraction? Where do you think that sort of reluctance came from?
I think it's a bit crazy, to be honest with you. I think sometimes you see, you know, sometimes you will see the media as a bit of distraction, but it's all about time management and managing your time. And that's something that I'm there to kind of teach these girls media training. This is how you deal with the media. This is what you say. This is what you don't say. Don't feel pressurized to answer anything. Take your time. But the problem being is that you have to understand you need the media, because you need people to be talking about. You need people to know who you are. And therefore, once people are aware of who you are, brands and you know, companies will look at this person like, I'd like to associate or align my brand with this person, because, you know, she comes across very well in media. You know, she's got a bit of a personality. She's got great banter. And we're now beginning to see that.
Yeah.
And I also think that maybe Anna is a bit more of a shyness type of thing.
Yeah.
Like, it was like, I don't confident speaking to the media. I just want to focus on my boxing.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it was very much a bit of both of those things. But now look at her, when, you know, she's done so much last year. She's about to be in one of the biggest fights.
Yeah. I was going to say, it was great to see. It was really, really great to see her come out her shell and have more of that moment in there. And I think, you know, similarly, a boxer who I think is also incredibly talented as well, that you also represent, is Chantel Cameron. And it would be great to see her get some more coverage and some more pickup as she, you know, moves through the ranks and goes forward for her own world title fights. But as you say, it's almost a symbiotic relationship. They've got to get the media on their side, talking about them, getting people excited for their world title fights, and then they've got to obviously win those world title fights as well, right? Because your star is only as big as your athletic sort of accomplishments as well.
Exactly. And it's also like, you know, with Savannah and both Chantel, we kind of mix them up a little bit with football.
Yeah,
because you know, Savannah's a Newcastle United supporter and Chantel's a Northampton, you know, that's their respective areas of where they grew up. Well, Savannah is Hartlepool, but Newcastle would beat her team.
Yeah,
so, you know, we mixed up stuff for them when they both had their world title fights. Chantel was only just on TalkSport a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
You know, it's all about keeping that momentum up. What, no one's asking you to do a media interview every week, but it's just trying to keep yourself out there.
Yeah.
Just a little bit more each month, so people don't forget who you are.
Yeah, definitely.
And just being recognised within your sport is just simply not enough. Because if I was a brand, for example, like Puma, and I always use Puma as an example because we've had conversations with them.
Yeah.
And I looked at Chantel and Savannah and I'd be like, well, they're world champions, but issue is, who do they appeal to outside of boxing? Am I going to get my return of investment if I pay them per month to do a couple of paid campaigns for them?
Yeah.
That's what the girls, it's about educating the girls and making them understand that it's not that you're not talented. It's not that brands don't like you. It's the fact that they need to make sure that the money they're investing in you is they're going to make that back. And even more so, they want to make more than what they've invested in you.
Yeah.
So if you don't appeal to the music, to the fashion, to the lifestyle, to the other sports sectors, I'll be honest, if I was Puma, I wouldn't pay to sponsor you. And what I'm saying now is something I have said to the girls.
Yeah.
You might just get a couple of jumpers a month.
Yeah.
Or a couple of free jogging pants a month.
Yeah.
And you have to accept that. So that's where you both need to step up, because there is only so much I can tell you, but you also need to put that in, put the work in as well.
Yeah, no, definitely. That is such a brutal reality, and it's one that I have to say I feel guilty for, because I'm 100% responsible for that school of thought, having spent a lot of my years working in brand and sports marketing. But it is exactly as you say, the value in terms of the advertising return on investment, the brand association, why the brands that I've worked for over the years have paid the incredible amounts of money that they have paid to athletes that have been happy to, you know, help, particularly athletes who are up and coming, has been because of the resonance that you say they have with culture, with entertainment, and with fan groups that go beyond their core sport, I think. And that's also, you know, a huge challenge for women's sport that I also think, though, the brands have to take a responsibility for and say that there was times when brands did step up and invest actually in growing the star of athletes before their sport became mainstream. And so this is where I think brands also do have to take a bit of responsibility, though, and say, if they do see a aspiring, really great, talented female athlete, to take the chance and put them in their campaigns, integrate them in their products, because fans do follow, right? Because as you start to see somebody more and more on TV and billboards,
exactly, yeah,
and magazines, on social, you start to ask yourself questions, oh, who is that? And I think there is a really great room for brands who are brave enough and brands who really are, you know, wanting to pick forward all those commitments we saw last year around inclusivity and representation, talking here to say, we've ignored women's sport, we've ignored women's participation in sport for a long time, and how do we use these really great females who are doing great in their fields to try and encourage more young girls to participate in sport. Back to your point earlier about you and the representation of not seeing Southeast Asian women and Black women in the sports agency side of things, to say the more it becomes normalized to see women in sport and women really being celebrated for being athletes, I think the more normalized those commercial relationships become, because the participation increases and the level therefore of performance increases because there's more competition. I do think there has to be a bit more ownership taken on the brand side too, to help sports agents like you and your female athletes.
No, 100%. And you know, we are seeing a change now. It's a small change, but in some respects it's quite significant.
Yeah.
So us, you know, it's just all about continuing to build upon what we've created.
Yeah.
And to continue to push forward and continue to speak louder and make sure that our voices are heard. You know, it is what it is, and we just actually, you know, I don't like that saying because it's almost giving us, you know, a definitive ending to something. So I'll rephrase that. It is what we make it to be.
Yes.
So this is it now. It's in our hands, and we just need to keep pushing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, definitely. I think staying in the conversation, being relevant, turning up, knocking on doors is something that you and I, you know, have been speaking about a lot in the last few weeks as well. And another a sort of element I wanted to touch on with you now was, you've obviously had this great opportunity to do both avenues that you love, from your you know, your early days of playing sport right the way now to your professional career of both the sports journalism. You obviously are creative director of one of the most successful football podcasts, I think, actually in the UK, the Football Weekly Show, right? I'm sure it is.
Yeah, the Football Weekly Show is on hold at the moment. Yeah. So it was actually, we actually managed to get it on Sky Channel and Virgin, yeah, and Freeview a couple, yeah, of years ago.
Yeah.
And literally, I was the first British Asian woman to actually have my own sports show,
yeah, put, yeah,
placed on mainstream media. So it was building, the momentum was building. The problem being was the time,
okay,
to actually, you know, focus and kind of, you know, it took up a lot of time trying to find the right presenter, trying to, you know, find the right people to kind of work on it. But we are slowly making a comeback. So as soon as that comes back, I will definitely be updating everybody on that.
Good. No, good. No, it'd be awesome too. And obviously, and you work obviously now for 442, which has become a cult in, let's say, football and culture here in the UK. Do you think that's an area as well that could start to support women's football more through the coverage, through the kind of stories you tell about women's football? Because I think right now, for example, here in the UK, the premier footballing competition for women, the WSL, has some really great, incredible big superstars like Alex Morgan, who came over, you know, just at the tail end of last season, here to play for Spurs, regrettably, as an Arsenal fan for me. but it's still great to have a superstar come like that in women's world football come to the Premier League, to the women's Premier Division. Do you want to, do you think the having more of those sort of, let's say, celebrity type players can also help the profile of the women's game? Or do you think they detract actually from the great wealth of really good homegrown talent that the WSL has also managed to encourage on?
I think it's the same across all boards. We're always talking about the Premier League and we're saying that, you know, our focus should be on academy players and pushing grassroots players and homegrown players. But once in a lifetime, you will get somebody like Alex Morgan or somebody like a Messi or Ronaldo that's going to elevate the league and get people excited and get people talking about it. As long as our homegrown players aren't forgotten about and are being given the fair opportunities, as long as they've earned those opportunities, that's how it should be across anything. You're going for a coaching role, if you're going for a management role, you need to pick the person that is best for the job. Not because they tick a box, not because pressure is being put upon you, because we're seeing, you know, we see a lack of diversity across coaching, management. You know, we were talking about, you know, not having enough British Asian players that play in the Premier League or play in football as a whole. It's, yeah, there are a lot of issues there, a lot of issues that I do agree with. However, they need to be, they need to look at themselves and be like, am I as good as that person? Do I deserve that opportunity or deserve to get that position over that other person? So it's important that we make sure that these people are being chosen for the right reasons. You know, because I think a lot of emphasis is always, you know, has been predominantly put on, there is not enough of this in this sport or that in that sport. But as far as I'm concerned, the best person deserves the job. But the people that are also doing the recruitment, they also need to look at that and be like, am I choosing the best person or am I not choosing that person because their skin colour doesn't fit? I'm sorry, but that has to be said. But yeah, with 442, I've predominantly mainly interviewed female footballers from the WSL, and it's been absolutely fantastic. You know, the coverage, the having great features within the print magazine. It's been great. Yeah. Good relationship with a lot of the clubs now, especially Arsenal.
Great. Glad to hear that. Glad to hear they're representing.
And Chelsea as well. So yeah, it's been brilliant, and it's pushing. And 442 are very open to opportunities. They try their best to make sure that they're covering all angles. So yeah, it's been a great opportunity for me.
Yeah, no, it's really good to see that. And I just want to track back there and talk about what you're saying there about balancing the debates that happen around, do we put people in the right places? Do we put the right coverage because it's deserved or because we're trying to tick boxes? And I think this is it's a really good, relevant conversation to have, because I think one of two things happen. I think there's not a lot of people also feel self-conscious the other way, where I have been in job interview situations where I have been privy to discussions of people saying, oh, you know, we want to hire them, but we want to make sure that when they come in the door, people don't think we've just given them the job, because it's quite clear we don't have that lack of representation. But I think the other debate that needs to be had is to say, there's never any hesitation about hiring one more white male middle-class guy in the sports arena. No one ever says, will anybody think we're just hiring him because he looks like the rest of us? Why is there a pause when it's a group that doesn't actually have normally a good level of representation and participation in the game? So I think we also need to confront ourselves and say that sometimes we are going to have to make decisions that will feel visibly uncomfortable to people. But we also have to support the person we recruit into that space who hasn't had that representation and opportunity to really be validated in the fact that they are good enough and that they've been hired on merit. And that, yes, people are going to talk and are going to ask the questions about, was it a diversity exercise, et cetera, whatever crude term they want to put it on. And the organization does have to stand up and be tall and say, yes, it was, because we recognize we actually haven't given this group a chance. We went out there and we made sure we recruited someone who was really well qualified, and you as everyone in this organization has to take ownership now to try and say, how do we encourage more talented people from that group that hasn't typically had opportunities here to continue to want to apply to work here? Because there's also a thing that I choose not to work at certain organizations because I know that they don't have a great track record of progression and inclusion. So I think that also needs to be talked about as well. I think more employers need to become more visibly happy and comfortable with having those uncomfortable conversations about how it's happening. Otherwise, we don't turn the tide.
Exactly. Everything that you've said is just totally spot on. Exactly. That's exactly how it is. And really, it's all about how do we push on that to make, you know, significant change where the recruiter themselves is sort of feeling that they're under pressure to just tick a box.
Yeah.
Or the person that's actually going for that job feels that they're never going to get that job because there's just all they have to do is look at the company structure and look at the people that are higher up and be like, well, hold on a minute, I don't see anybody that represents or replicates my skin color or my culture.
Yeah. So, and I would just want to spend some time with you just taking a little bit of a deep dive into the career and life lessons there that you have really made you and shaped your journey, and in particular have taught you to kind of find ways through difficult times to succeed. And I want to revisit a bit there that you talked about your addiction and all the kind of skills it taught you both personally and professionally. Do you mind just talking a little bit more around that?
No, absolutely not. You know, when I talk about things that have obviously helped shape my career and stuff, I do refer to what I went through in terms of my addiction, because through that particularly hard battle, as what I'd like to call it, probably one of my toughest fights, is that it taught me how to be resilient. It taught me to never give up. So in some respects, you can relate that towards a sports athlete, because their whole, you know, their whole type of attitude has to be to never give up and to keep going, because they want to be a champion, or they want to continue to win. They want to be successful in what they do.
Yeah.
So I always kind of refer what I went through and what I learned through, like, to get myself through the other side. And I've done that into my, you know, into my professional career as well. To continue to go, if the door closes, that means that door was never meant for me, because something bigger and better is on its way. And I think it's all about positive mental attitude.
Yeah, no, definitely. And that's so beautifully put. And but I think also from a very difficult circumstance, right? Because there's so much unfortunate social stigma that exists in lots of groups. Like I personally, you know, I was brought up in an African family and in a Black culture mostly. And there's a lot of silence around issues to do with mental health, to do with addiction. And that I've seen really cripple a lot of people in my life personally and professionally. And there's this sort of hushness that goes on with people not talking about it, not talking about the positives that it can teach you, as you talk through there about the resilience, that mindset, that ability to be able to get yourself from difficult situations and not have them destroy you, but instead use them as building blocks to think about better opportunities. Did you find that? How hard did you find it to start to open up and talk about that? Because we've obviously spoken about how, you know, your background as well, heritage and culture wise, also made that incredibly difficult for you to first to voice out.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there was no one, if you talk about 15 years ago, there was no one, like no Asian woman that would be speaking, that would even dream about speaking about something as, you know, as severe as addiction within the community or something that they're actually going through themselves. So to have myself find that courage, and, you know, sometimes it's like one of my, what someone said to me, another one of my friends said to me a couple of weeks ago, that, you know, I should give myself a pat on the back, because, you know, it's all about trying to eradicate that stigma of shame, a line that I use ahead of a lot of interviews that I do, because nobody should feel ashamed of something that they've gone through or that they're going through. Everybody should be able to speak up about something that matters to them, to encourage others to speak up, but also ultimately help yourself at the same time. You know, just because you're Asian or just because you're Black or just because you come from a particularly strict community and culture, you shouldn't be silenced if you're struggling or suffering with something, whether that be mental health or addiction, or, you know, you could suffer from an eating disorder. It's none of those particular issues. No one should be silent. You should be able to seek help without feeling that stigma of shame. And unfortunately, it still very much exists within our culture now. So I'm going to continue to speak up about it and make sure that my voice is heard to encourage more people to realise, yes, you can speak about it. You've got nothing to be ashamed of. Go out and get help. You can't get it from the people that are within your family or your support network or your friends. Mm-hmm. There are other people out there that will listen to you. Just don't give up. Just keep going.
Yeah, no, that's so inspirational. I think your friend is understating the fact when they say that you should get a pat on the back. I think, you know, you should be given a medal of honor, because it's such a wonderful example of that level of inspirational vulnerability that, you know, I admire so much when I see in people like you, because it's going to that place of great public discomfort, knowing that you're doing it for the greater good of people and giving them a platform, as you say, to be able to feel, to own their space, own their identity, and own the experiences that they have, to in order to shed a light on improving difficulties for people. And I absolutely commend you entirely for that. And I am so proud and happy to have you here to talk about that. So thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
Yeah, and sort of looking also at other opportunities and other sort of learnings you've had, I think one in particular I wanted to touch on, you and I'm always really interested in, is when you're the first to occupy a particular high profile position like you did there, where you were the sports editor, the first female Asian sports editor of a newspaper, how did that sense of responsibility of being the first to achieve such a great accolade anyways professionally, but also in a particular profession in the media, which has come under a lot of scrutiny recently, and rightfully so, I'm sure you'd agree, with certain representation of certain identities. How did that moment make you feel? Because that's real two sort of glass ceilings that you're sort of smashing there in one. How does it feel to be in that position? Do you feel an added sense of pressure, an added sense of responsibility that other people don't necessarily have because, there's others like them who have occupied those positions?
I think when you go back to that particular time, so we're talking about the early 2000s here, so obviously finishing uni, and I didn't think for one minute that I'd be in that particular position so quick. But the particular publication that I was working for was a very, very small company, and they were just starting out. So it was almost like I was learning and like thrown into the deep end and learning on the job. So when they first initially made me a news editor, it was just a regional newspaper, but we were massive. We were going out to every single, part of West London. And then obviously being a news editor wasn't my dream, because sports was my passion. So I ended up becoming a sports editor. And then all the people that were kind of joining our company and working with us, they'd actually come from other publishing companies like Trinity Mirror. They fancied a switch over, and they fancied a change and working for a different regional paper. So, when they joined our company, they were like, you do realise that you are the youngest ever news editor of a regional newspaper in London, and you were also the first ever British Asian female to become sports editor in print. And I was up, because digital didn't exist then. I don't even think we had a website then. There was talk about how the world was going to change, and websites were going to come out and stuff. So for me, I was like, really? And if you want my honest opinion, I didn't really pay much attention to it. I just continued to do my job, because for me, I always try to not use my race or my gender to kind of promote myself and to gain more opportunities. I was just like, here's my opportunity. This is how I show them what I'm capable of doing. That's by showing them how good I am. But as the years went on, I actually realised the enormity of that particular title that was given to me. And then now I'm seeing all these Asian girls that are coming through the ranks. A lot of them are working for like The Guardian, for all mainstream media. And I was like, I've been there, done that, worn the t-shirt before any of you guys ever did it. It's no disrespect to them. Nowadays, you could just Google someone's name and see all of their achievements. Back in that day, you wouldn't have been able to have done that. Print was a very, very, very tough industry to build a name up in. I probably would be really, really high up in the journalism industry, in that particular career, if I had not gone through my addiction and had my breakdown in my 20s. Unfortunately, I had to walk away from that career. So for me, I felt incredibly proud when I see all these different people from like the Black and Asian communities. Now they're sports journalists. I want to see more sports editors. I want to see people in higher broadcast positions. I think we're getting there, but we've still got a long way to go. But people actually forget that when I look at the likes of, say, these are just a few people that I actually really rate, if I have to say. I think they're absolutely fantastic at their job. Reshmin Chowdhury, I think she's amazing. She's humble, she's so down to earth, incredibly good at what she does. She knows her sport inside out. You can feel the passion as well every time you see her on broadcast. But for me, I think she kind of started, like all of these girls, like when I've had had a conversation, or I've read up on their careers themselves, because I find it really interesting. It's like none of them done a journalism degree. Like back in that day, you go and do a journalism degree.
You had to, It was part of your rite of passage.
So what they did do, they all did a different degree, whether that be a business degree or a social degree or whatever, and they decided, hold on a minute, I actually really want to be a journalist. But not many of them actually started in sports. You'd have to start in a different section.
Discipline.
I think Reshvin went on to work for Real Madrid, which is an absolutely amazing thing to represent our culture, to have done that. People should be applauding her more for that, to be perfectly honest with you. But I was before all of those girls, but because there was no digital, no social media, because I couldn't progress my career because of my addiction. So yeah. I probably would be in the same position as all of them girls, but it was never a competition for me. When I look at that, I think I was a part of starting something, but nobody will ever really know that because there was no digital, there was nothing you could track. It was just a print, you know, a print type of industry back then. But honestly, I feel so proud when I see all those girls and I think, look how far we've come.
Yeah, no, definitely. And it's interesting that you say that there's no track record. And I always say to people, I think sometimes we fixate just because of, as you said, all the digitalness and the readiness of access through social and the sort of website culture that we've got, which of course is incredibly helpful for raising profile and distributing media, I should say. But one of the things that I think is really, really powerful, and I think sometimes a lot of people don't give themselves credit for, is that probably somewhere along the way, those young women that you're talking about coming through now and those women like Reshma who are, you know, obviously got great broadcasting careers, probably along the way, they in their communities, people heard of you, heard of other people like you who were doing really great at big sort of regional newspapers, cutting those first places, even though, you know, you yourself were so focused on just being the best at what you did. And that probably gave them the permission and the confidence quietly to go after that, because probably if they never ever knew of anybody in that space occupying those seats, no matter how not publicly visible they were, it probably doesn't give that first source of courage to even dream about walking into that space. So I think, you know, you don't do yourself a disservice. I do think that probably if you were to talk to them, they would be this consciousness of the community, because there's always a recognition when you see someone in your community doing something that isn't, let's say, a norm or commonplace, that you do use them and as an example of sort of telling your parents, there's a reason I should do this because actually Sonia Randev has done X, Y, Z and I could go and I could have a similarly successful career in a respected profession like journalism, because I think that's another thing that's really valued in a lot of cultures, that those kind of respectability of carving yourself a career.
No, 100% agree. I mean, there was people that I'd heard of as well when I was growing up. You know, I'd say more so in the news political side, but I just thought, hold on, you're still Asian, and it's brilliant to see you, you know, work in the media, and that's inspiring for me.
Yeah.
But and don't get me wrong, like when I first started writing for the newspaper, people in my own area were coming up to me saying, Sonia, I saw your name in the paper, and got delivered through my door.
Yeah, and that's such a wonderful moment. Yeah, and you should be. And
I feel more proud from that, really, than anything, because these are people that I grew up with, so it's more of a personal meaning to me.
Yeah, it definitely, and as you say, it gives that hope in your community of that visibility and representation that they otherwise didn't get that affirmation of in media, which is such an important part of shaping culture. And when you are now sort of looking forward to your career, you know, you've got all these great relationships with lots of great athletes that you're working with at the moment and you're building really good profiles for. But when you fast forward 20 years on from now, because all of those will be successful, I have no doubt. You are just so driven and talented. But what would you like to be your legacy? What would you like to be the thing that people remember you for, or you want to overhear someone say that will make it feel like everything you've been through, both personally and professionally, was worth it?
Oh, that's a good one. Because there's so many things that you'd like to be remembered for, but I want people to kind of, there's a couple of things, but
you can go for a couple of things. Why not?
I think ultimately the most important thing is how you treat people. And I think when I was going through my, you know, my tough times of addiction, I didn't treat people as well as I should have done. And that's something I've always actually wanted to say quite honestly. But I'm quite thankful and quite lucky that those people could clearly see and understand that I wasn't in a very good place. So therefore, which is still not acceptable, like, you know, talking to people in a certain way, treating them a certain way, it's not acceptable, but it's also trying to make people understand what that person is actually going through and why they're being a certain way. So I think ultimately it's to be remembered how you treat people, how you look after people, because what we give in is what we get back. And that's something that's taken me a good few years to realise that. And I think it's important that we stick to that, that to be proactive and not reactive to things. Not everything's going to work out for you. Not everything's going to be your way. Keep cool with people. Try and be as professional as you can, But if something hasn't worked out, that's fine. It's not the end of the world. You just move on, they move on. But it's important to still keep that professionalism. And that's another thing I've learned over the years as well, is to work really hard on being that professional person, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, definitely does. Definitely does. That's a treatment of and respect of others and self, you know. And I think that's definitely something that I would say I've got so much, even though we've known each other for a short sense of time, just from people, how they talk about you, who I know in industry stuff. You definitely do give out both of those things. And I think it speaks to your humility. Although you've been so successful, you've also experienced real down moments, and they've taught you that trueness and that value of being, you know, authentic and respectful to people and treating them how you want to be treated. And I think, you know, that's something that often people don't pay enough attention to as a legacy, but I think there's so much richness in that, both professionally and personally. So thank you so much for taking the time to share your incredibly uplifting human story and your incredibly impressive professionally story too. I think it's such a nice way to cap off the Women's History Month celebration. So thank you so much for everybody who's tuned in to listen to In Her Corner. I've been with the absolutely incredible Sonia Randev.
Thank you.